This episode is sponsored by Audible.com. If you love listening to podcasts, you will love listening to audiobooks too. And I have a great offer for you. If you go to audibletrial.com/courtjunkie, you can get a free audiobook download if you sign up for a free 30-day trial. One book I would recommend that's somewhat fitting for today's episode is called I Am the Central Park Jogger, A Story of Hope and Possibility. It's a book written by the actual Central Park jogger, Trisha Miley, and you'll see how this ties into today's episode in just a little bit. But you can get that book for free, or another book of your choosing, just by going to audibletrial.com/courtjunkie, and you can cancel at any time. Taking advantage of that offer is also a great way to support this podcast. That's audibletrial.com/courtjunkie. Hello, this is Jillian, and welcome to today's Court Junkie Brief on False Confessions. So often I hear people say that a defendant must be guilty because they confessed. But is that always true? I can tell you right now that it's not, that false confessions really are a thing, and that even though you think it could never happen to you, and hopefully you're right, you might just be wrong. Many of you have listened to my episodes about Melissa Kalusinski, the former daycare worker who was convicted of murder after confessing to throwing a small child down on the ground. And if you've been listening, you'll know that Melissa's defense team firmly believes that Melissa was pressured into confessing to something that she didn't actually do. I've had a few people contact me after listening to those episodes, and they asked why in the world Melissa would say that she did something when she really didn't, especially given the fact that her life was essentially on the line. And the answer might not be so black and white. I want to start this brief out with a conversation I had with my father, who happens to be a former law enforcement officer. He's a pretty tough guy, and when I brought up the topic of false confessions, I was half expecting him to tell me that it was just a bunch of BS, and that false confessions didn't really happen in real life. But I was surprised. He actually backed up the notion that they do happen. He told me that one day, while he was working as a detective, a robbery suspect was brought into the police station. He interviewed the man, who, after about 20 minutes or so, confessed to the robbery. But they later discovered that the man actually had nothing to do with it. And when my dad asked him why he would confess to something he didn't do, the man said that he thought they would go easier on him if he just said that he did it. So it turns out, false confessions aren't exactly uncommon. Of the Innocence Project's 341 DNA exonerations, more than 25% gave full false confessions or incriminating statements. I spoke with Alan Hirsch, a professor and chair of the Justice and Law Studies program at Williams College in Williamstown, Massachusetts. Alan also runs the website truthaboutfalseconfessions.com. My first question to him was, how did he get so involved in false confessions?
So I had an interest in it going back 30 years to when I was a law clerk on the United States Court of Appeals for the Third Circuit, and I worked on a crazy case involving a confession that went all the way up to the Supreme Court. So it was always in the back of my mind as an interesting subject. And then about 15 years ago, when I came to Williams College, almost immediately, I read a piece in the New York Times about the Central Park jogger case that happened to be by my colleague on the Williams faculty, Saul Kassin, who's a leading authority, maybe the world's leading authority on false confessions. And I was fascinated and outraged by what I read about the Central Park jogger case, which I had only been loosely familiar with. And I went to talk to him, and one thing led to another. And I began studying the subject and writing about it, and eventually becoming expert in it to the point that I work in the area.
For those of you who don't know about the Central Park 5 case, it takes place back in 1989. A 28-year-old female jogger named Trisha Miley was brutally attacked in New York's Central Park. The attack was so severe that Trisha was in a coma for 12 days. 5 teenagers were taken into custody and interviewed for hours until they eventually confessed to taking part in the crime. And even though they all recanted their confessions, all five were convicted. But in 2002, after the five had served about 13 years in prison, the real rapist came forward and confessed. And DNA evidence backed up that confession. The Central Park Five's convictions were officially vacated. In 2003, the men received a $41 million settlement from the city of New York. So did you have any involvement in the Central Park Five case at all? Or was it just that that's what kind of got you into it?
No, yeah, that just heightened my interest in the subject. So there were five different false confessions given in that case. They were detailed, they were videotaped, and it was just amazing to ponder that you could have that many false confessions in a single case leading to convictions. That case, as I said, I was already interested in it, but that really sparked a greater interest.
Five false confessions in a single case. So why do people confess to something that they didn't do?
So there are a lot of reasons. Some people come forward and confess voluntarily. The example we always give is when the Lindbergh baby was kidnapped, more than 200 people came forward and confessed. And in that case, out of desire for notoriety, which you often get in high-profile cases, and sometimes people voluntarily confess to protect someone else. But the most common reason and the most alarming is certain widespread interrogation methods are used routinely by law enforcement, and they are potent, and they break innocent people down as well as guilty people.
Are you talking about like the Reed technique? Is that one of them?
Yes, that's the main one, and it goes by other names, and there are other groups that teach it, but that's basically it.
Can you like explain a little bit about what that technique is? Or,
well, that consists primarily of two steps. First, the suspect is confronted with evidence of his guilt, sometimes exaggerated or fabricated, and any denials, any efforts to maintain his innocence are aggressively cut off. So basically, you are communicating to the suspect, we know you're guilty and there's no way you're going to persuade us otherwise. And having brought on despair with that, law enforcement then engages in a second step called minimization, which are various steps to imply or even explicitly say that if only you confess, you'll get off relatively easy. So they bring on despair and then they supply the lifeline. Mm. And that combination, convincing people that maintaining innocence is futile, whereas confessing guilt will bring benign consequences, you know, that combination leads people to conclude that confessing is the best or only escape from obviously a highly stressful situation.
Right, and especially if they're being interrogated for hours and hours, right?
Exactly.
If you've been following the mainstream news lately, it probably would have been hard for you to miss the news that Brendan Dassey, one of the subjects of the Netflix documentary Making a Murderer, just had his conviction overturned and is set to be released from prison this week. Brendan was 16 years old when he was accused of helping his uncle, Stephen Avery, rape and murder photographer Teresa Hallback in October 2005. He later claimed that his confession had been coerced, but he was convicted anyway. And then in August 2016, Brendan's conviction was overturned, and the judge slammed the confession in his ruling, saying, "The investigators repeatedly claimed to already know what happened on October 31st and assured Dassey that he had nothing to worry about. These repeated false promises, when considered in conjunction with all relevant factors, most especially Dassey's age, intellectual deficits, and the absence of a supportive adult, rendered Dassey's confession involuntary under the 5th and 14th Amendments." And not only did the judge say that Brendan's confession was involuntary, he doubted the credibility of it too. He wrote, "Crucial details evolved through repeated leading and suggestive questioning and generally stopped changing only after the investigators, in some manner, indicated to Dassey that he finally gave the answer they were looking for. Purportedly corroborative details could have been the product of contamination from other sources, including the investigators' own statements and questioning, or simply logical guesses, rather than actual knowledge of the crime." So another question I had, what goes into determining that a confession is false?
So we categorize confessions as false if they meet one of four criteria. In a lot of the proven false confessions cases, it was DNA or other scientific evidence that established infallibly that the person could not have committed the crime. In a second category of cases, the real culprit was apprehended under circumstances that left no doubt that he committed the crime. There are some cases where it turns out, this is a fascinating subset of proven false confessions, it was physically impossible for the person who was convicted to have committed the crime, even though he confessed. For example, he was out of the country at the time of the confession, or was behind bars, or has some other airtight alibi. And then there's a tiny subset of these cases where there was no crime at all committed. The classic example being the murder case where the so-called victim shows up alive.
Mm.
So I should add, those are the cases of proven false confessions, of which there are several hundred. But there are many, many more cases where we have good reason to believe they were false. We might call them likely or probable false confessions, but they're not proven because of the rigid definition of when a confession is absolutely established to be false.
So I know a lot of people, and I've heard a lot of even some of my listeners say that they would never falsely confess to something that they didn't do. What would you say to those people?
Yeah, so that's a common reaction. It's so counterintuitive that an innocent person would confess. So partly I respond with data. You know, as I shared with you before, dozens and dozens of people alone in the, confessing to the kidnapping the Lindbergh baby. But also, if people say, I would never confess, you have to get them to understand that this is not something that happens in an everyday setting. It's people who are being grilled by professional interrogators intent on breaking them down and trained in the best means of doing so. So as I tell juries around the country, the problem with these interrogation techniques isn't that they aren't effective. It's that they're too effective. If I could just go back, earlier you mentioned the length of time, and that's an important point to touch on. In one major study of proven false confessions, the interrogation was 6 hours or longer in more than 3/4 of the cases. So just as you suggested, people are worn down over a long period. But it's important to realize you get confessions following fairly short interrogations, too. Just as there are certain populations, the mentally ill, juveniles, that are overrepresented in the population of false confessors, but it's a mistake to conclude that only those people confess falsely, just as it's a mistake to conclude that only long interrogations produce false confessions. You know, these false confessors come in all shapes and sizes and in all kinds of circumstances.
So I've also followed a couple of cases where in the post-conviction phase, some evidence such as DNA or whatever that may be shows that the defendant is truly innocent. But it's really difficult to get that person exonerated due to their false confession. It's almost as if that confession is an additional hurdle for them.
Oh, that's a really serious problem.
Yeah, I was going to say, I'm not sure if you followed the Melissa Kalusinski case. It's from here in Illinois, but we're sort of experiencing that here. She's a daycare worker, and she confessed to throwing a child down on the ground. And she was convicted. She's been in prison for about 7 or so years now. And her attorneys, she's actually Kathleen Zellner is her attorney, you know, is trying to get her out. And they've produced evidence that showed that the child actually did not have the head injury that they thought he did years ago. But there's that false confession, and she's saying it's false, and it's a difficult hurdle for them to get over.
It's an enormous hurdle. You know, we've run into this all the time, and it demonstrates how counterintuitive the idea of a false confession is. So there are a lot of cases where DNA revealed that someone convicted of a crime was actually innocent. So it's even stronger evidence than the case you're citing.
Mm-hmm.
And in these cases, the district attorney's office has refused to cooperate in getting the person exonerated and released. They simply refuse to believe that someone who confessed could be innocent. Or they have a tough time accepting that they put someone behind bars who was innocent. So often what they'll do is they'll change their theory of the case. So maybe DNA shows that the person who was convicted and confessed wasn't at the crime scene. And so the prosecutor says, okay, well, they weren't there, but they must have been an accomplice because they wouldn't have confessed otherwise.
Right.
And even if there's no evidence to support that theory and it bears no relationship to the confession that got the person convicted in the first place, we find prosecutors clinging to that new theory. So one of the things I wrote a scholarly article proposing that in cases of DNA exonerations, at least, a new prosecutor be appointed,
mm-hmm.
Someone who can take a fresh look at the case. because people understandably get invested in their cases, and no one wants to admit that they put someone behind bars who was innocent.
I wanted to interview Alan last week, but he was testifying in a homicide trial out of New York all week. And in addition to that trial, he has now testified as a false confessions expert in 16 different states.
Well, first of all, I've testified in 25 cases in 16 states. Typically, homicide or sexual abuse cases, those are the most common. Different states have different approaches to the admissibility of expert testimony in general, and sometimes confessions experts in particular. But in most states, it's generally in the discretion of the trial court, meaning it's up to the judge to determine whether the expert has something useful to add that will help the jury decide the case. But the trend is in the right direction. The more we've come to learn about false confessions, the more judges are allowing expert testimony about it.
Can you give me some examples of cases that you've been involved in? Are you allowed to do that?
I'm allowed, but there are just so many. You asked me, I'll give you one which tragically resulted in a conviction. Originally a mistrial in which 11 jurors voted innocent and they retried the case and the guy was convicted. This is an internalized false confession, and at least I'm convinced it was false. But someone convicted or accused first, later convicted, of killing his parents. Mm. And after many hours of a really aggressive interrogation, he breaks down and says he did it and starts describing how he did it and gets all of the details wrong. So he says that he did it with someone, but it was clearly a crime that was committed solo. He gets the murder weapon wrong. It's just about everything wrong, enough that should have been a major red flag, but because he confessed, he was prosecuted anyway. Now, it turns out that GPS technology establishes that he was a long way away from the crime. So it's one thing after another that pointed to innocence, and yet he was convicted. I mean, this is one that still keeps me up at night, but so it goes.
Oh, so he's still convicted to this day?
Yep, absolutely.
I saw on your website, you were talking a little bit about a social science experiment that was done at the college where you work. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, so this is a fascinating experiment in which college students were asked to do input on a computer, so type things up, and they were told that some aspect of the inputting was being tested. They had no idea what the real purpose of the experiment was. They were warned to avoid hitting the Alt key because that would cause the computer system to crash. And then, lo and behold, after they start typing, someone marches in and accuses them, says, oh my God, the system crashed, you hit the Alt key, which of course they hadn't done. And all of these subjects initially maintain their innocence. They say, I didn't hit the Alt key. But for a controlled group, some of them, there is a confederate of the experimenter, someone who was sort of just hanging around in the room, who claims to be an eyewitness, says, no, I saw you really did hit the Alt key. And faced with that confrontation with false evidence, a surprising number of them actually confess. They say, yep, I hit the Alt key. But here's what's really intriguing about this experiment. A non-trivial number of them go on to explain how it is they came to hit the Alt key.
Wow.
And they concoct some narrative. They've actually come to believe that they did it. And so this is illustrative of one of the categories of false confessions that's really intriguing, what we call the internalized false confession, in which the suspect, they end up being a defendant typically, actually comes to believe that they committed the crime. And this happens, it's not as common as other categories, but it happens more than you would ever imagine.
Wow, that is a fascinating study. And the students had no idea that was going to happen?
Right. No, they're completely caught by surprise. They have no reason to think that they did hit the Alt key, except that they're told that they did. But really, this reflects how malleable our minds are and our memories are. And we can come to believe when someone tries hard to convince us that something happened, that it happened, even something like us committing a crime.
What would you say is the biggest misperception about false confessions?
Well, I think it's something we talked about earlier, and that is only someone mentally ill or subject to torture. Only these really extreme cases or circumstances can produce false confessions. And the truth is, it could happen to anyone. The ranks of false confessors include some educated people, some people familiar with the law enforcement system, and so forth. It could happen to anyone. It doesn't require torture. In fact, these days, torture is almost non-existent, but false confessions are surprisingly frequent. So I'd say that's the single biggest misconception.
So what's the solution to all this? What can be done to not only decrease the amount of convictions based on false confessions, but to decrease the amount of false confessions at all? What do you think are some of the solutions to these false confessions? Like, what do you think needs to be done?
Right. So we talked about expert testimony, and it absolutely helps when judges allow experts to educate juries about false confessions. Another major reform that is in fact taking place is the videotaping of interrogations. Just increasingly, jurisdictions routinely tape interrogations. And this is really important because now judges and juries get to see the circumstances that led to a confession. But probably the most important reform would be in those interrogation techniques that we talked about, getting law enforcement not to grill people in the manner that they do, in which they break them down.
It's easy to play the blame game and to blame the police officers for these false confessions. But Allen doesn't believe that blame is properly placed at all.
You might wonder why law enforcement engage in these risky interrogation tactics. And the answer is that they don't believe they're interrogating innocent people. So part of the Reed technique is training law enforcement to determine whether people are innocent by a screening interview, where they look at body language and response to verbal cues. And they only, when they determine that someone is lying and therefore likely is guilty, it's only then that they engage in the interrogation techniques I was describing to you. Mm-hmm. The problem is that humans are poor lie detectors. Study after study shows that people, and this includes trained interrogators, cannot tell who is truthful based on body language and so forth. And so as a result, because of this failed screening device, many innocent people are interrogated. So that's a big part of the problem, is this faulty belief in human lie detection.
Because I guess it's easy to, you know, paint the police as the bad guys, you know, and think that they want to pin it on somebody, but that's not necessarily always
the case. Absolutely not. I mean, I think that in virtually all cases, the police genuinely believe they've got the right guy. So I think the problem is not with the police per se. And, you know, I personally have no problem with law enforcement. I think they do a great job. They put their lives on the line and so forth. That's all true. Unfortunately, they are trained in risky interrogation tactics that have this unfortunate collateral effect of breaking down innocent people.
Gotcha. So their training needs definite reforms, is what you're saying.
Yes, that's at the top of the wish list.
Can you tell us a little bit about your website?
Sure. So it's called Truth About False Confessions, and it includes some permanent material, like recommended reforms, just like some of the things we were talking about, recommended literature, frequently asked questions, things like that. And then I also post from time to time analysis of cases or literature or my own experience or whatever I'm moved to post about. So if people want to visit Truth About False Confessions, that would be great.
And that's all for this Court Junkie Brief on False Confessions. A special thanks to Allen Hirsch for taking the time to talk to me about this. Please visit his website, truthaboutfalseconfessions.com, for even more information. And thank you to all of you for your support. Those of you who are Patreon supporters are hearing these Court Junkie Brief episodes earlier than everybody else. If you want to become a supporter too, you can donate as little as $1 a month if you go to patreon.com/courtjunkie. I'm also working on some additional perks for Patreon as well. You can reach me on Twitter at courtjunkiepod, on Facebook by joining our Court Junkie discussion group, or you can email me at podcast@courtjunkie.com. Thank you, and until next time, Court Junkies.